Good morning from Zurich. You're listening to Monocle on Sunday with me, Tyler Brulé. Coming up on today's programme, my guest today, Marcus Schugel. He's made it around the corner from St. Gallen. We've also got Oliver Strabas here and also a new voice around the table. We've got Gorana Gurgic also with us today. But Marcus is here first for the menu of this programme. What's caught your eye today? What are we going to be talking about over the next hour or so, Marcus?
Looking at luxury brands, for instance, that are talking more into hospitality. Venice raising prices for entrance, having an entrance fee first, and a lot of political stuff that I can't count right now.
No, exactly. There's a lot they're going to be dissecting across that as well. Also, our editor-in-chief, Andrew Tuck, is going to be joining us from London, and we'll also get the latest from Istanbul.
I'm Hannah Lucinda Smith, and coming up later, I'll be bringing you a roundup from Turkey, including the German president's visit and what he brought with him, a surge of Turkish tourism in Greece's Aegean Islands, and a 16th century hammam, which is reopening this week in Istanbul.
Plus, we'll speak to the author and founder of S8 Nations, R. James Brading, on his new book, What Goliath Can Learn from David. Big Lessons from Small Nations. It's the 28th of April, 2024, live from Zurich. This is Monocle on Sunday.
Live from Zurich, this is Monocle on Sunday with Tyler Brulé.
Good morning. And indeed, it is a Monocle on Sunday. It is it's sort of a nice day here in Zurich. I think after the weather that's been here for the past week, we'll take it. I wasn't here, of course, as you might have heard in the intro to this. I was, of course, you were listening last week. I was in Spain anyway. Happily back, which is great. I'm happy to say that Oliver Strabas is here as well, professor of political science at Franklin University on the other side of the Alps in Lugano. Nice to see you. Good morning.
Good morning, Tyler.
School is wrapped up for the year. Any sit-ins and protests on campus? What's happening?
Always a very hot topic on our campus. Very difficult. We have many Jewish American students, but we also have many students from the Middle East. Is really a difficult situation for our university. But I think so far we are managing well. We try to have sober discussions about history, the geopolitical situations, and try to find as much common ground as we can.
Very good. I think we'll be unpacking that a little bit more as well. Marcus Schugel is here. He's the associate professor at St. Gallen University, the Institute for Marketing. Last time I saw you was at a marketing conference just around the corner here in Zurich. Have you been on campus lately? I'm not sure what the discourse is there or not over in St. Gallen.
I wasn't that much on the campus here. I was on the campus in Singapore for the last week. So
lucky you.
Yeah, so the discussions over there were a little bit different, but not that hectic, I think, as in the United States. And I think it's a challenging topic. We need to raise it and we need to find answers to this.
I'm going to bring Andrew Tuck in a little bit later, our editor-in-chief, on this, because there's this curious thing how we're very consumed in the West by this, but there's something happens, I think, once you sort of pass India, when you're in Hong Kong, when you're in Singapore, there are also more pressing geopolitical topics as well. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's not, you know, it's a very different situation for your students when they're in Singapore. I'm also very happy to say that Gorana Gurgic is here, senior researcher with the Swiss and Euro-Atlantic security team at ETH here in Zurich. Wonderful to have you here. Good morning.
Thank you so much for having me.
I mean, I have to ask you as well, ETH as well, not broken up for the year yet. We saw, of course, yesterday, Prime Minister Attal, of course, talking about, now sort of sit-ins, small protests at Sciences Po in Paris. Mm-hmm. What's happening up the hill at ETH here in Zurich?
Well, I have to say that I also came back from 4 weeks of whirlwind continent hopping and conferencing, so I haven't been on the campus up until a couple of days ago. And the other thing is that my role is blissfully research only, not teaching. So this, in at least the world of academia, is considered as a prize, though I love teaching. I've been teaching for the past 15 years when I was at the University of Sydney and still do some guest lecturing. But really, in terms of taking the pulse of the campus, I'm probably not the best person to talk about that at the moment for ETH. But from what I hear from my colleagues back in Australia, but also in the US where I was in San Francisco just a couple of weeks ago, the conversations are very heated and there are different perspectives, even within, you know, the sort of community that is very much pro two-state solution, pro ceasefire and so on. So I wouldn't, you know, when we talk about these things, I think we need to be really careful not to paint with too broad of brush strokes and to understand that there is still kind of a diversity of opinions even within that community that would like to see the cessation of violence in Gaza.
I also want to bring in Andrew Tuck, our editor-in-chief. He's in London this morning. Andrew, good morning.
Good morning, Tyler. And a topic here, of course, as well, this very fractious debate.
Andrew, maybe we can, I don't know if you've been around surveying campuses or what is happening out front. I was going to say, though, having been in Marbella last week, every morning I would have to walk by the Marbella International University. Now, I'm not sure if that's a famous university when you think about schools of higher education around the world, but I can say there was a lot of football going on. There was very loud music on campus. There were a lot of pink flamingos in the school. So it was sort of a sit-in of a very different kind.
Yeah, well, and some of it's going on wherever you go in the world. I was in Mallorca last week, and you certainly see some demonstrations there as well from students and people who are involved in this issue. And obviously, London has become a fulcrum of this debate on the streets and off. And there's lots. It's one of these issues that the police have found almost impossible to police in a way that both sides believe is fair. I think on the whole, most people think they've done a pretty good job. It's not there in their power to stop demonstrations. They can control the routes and the numbers, and they can control what people do and say. And certainly yesterday, some people were arrested for holding placards that were believed to be potentially racist. But it's a very tough thing for them to kind of hold this balancing line. But, you know, and then you get difficult things. Like yesterday, the Hyde Park took the decision to cover up the Holocaust memorial with tarpaulin, wrap it up so that it wouldn't get attacked or be daubed with paint by anybody coming to demonstrate. Now, a precautionary measure, there's no proof that anyone's going to do that. But it just looks awful when you're in a city that has to cover up something like the Holocaust memorial.
Yeah, of course, as well. And I can imagine, Andrew, that probably the pages, if not today, tomorrow as well, are also saying, you know, how are we in a situation that you don't also have, yeah, a deployment of course, law enforcement, people, security services to maybe protect it from afar? Because, of course, then suddenly you're shrouding something which is supposed to be a memorial. And of course, maybe to not the layman, but to the tourist passing everywhere else, you don't exactly know what that is.
No, and yeah, look, we have friends who empathise all across the board, and I think that what was being hinted at the beginning of this as well is what's interesting is often when you get people on the sidelines away from this, the most fractious ends of the debate, that people have quite nuanced views, you know, about what needs to happen. They're not always Jewish listeners and things, are not always great supporters of Netanyahu, for example. So you know, it's not that they have a singular view about the world. But, you know, I think what everyone finds a little bit difficult is that many of the demonstrators can't hold these two important beliefs in mind, which is one, that the hostages certainly need to be freed and returned to their families. And that two, you can take a stand against what Hamas stands for while believing that the attacks that are happening in Palestine must be held to account and must be held up to the strictest measures of what international law says.
Andrew, I'm going to set you the challenge of, let's say, ending on this note before we go to the news in about 16 minutes' time to end on a moment of levity. But I'm going to bring our educators and researchers in on this topic. But Andrew, it's a story that we were circulating around the company this week, which was a piece from the Wall Street Journal, which was saying that the class of 24 is sort of the pandemic class. We're talking about undergrads, that they went in to school, of course, at an extraordinary time. And they also, you know, of course, a time of lockdowns, all of those things. And they leave at a time of protest and just extraordinary division. And I'm wondering, maybe Oliver, I'll start with you. I mean, do you feel this as an educator all of this period? And the Wall Street Journal piece was focusing a little bit on, yes, you know, anxiety, of course, you know, being top of the agenda and looking at all of these challenges and saying that maybe university life, and I think a lot of it, this is where I was setting Andrew the challenge of having a moment of levity, just saying, That idea of fun on campus actually maybe getting into a little bit of trouble, not because of a political protest, but because you opened a keg, because maybe, I don't know, you threw, I don't know, someone's clothes out the window, all of the weird things that would happen on campus as a student, that's kind of maybe drifted away. And again, I think we have to remember that's maybe not all corners of the world, but certainly when we're talking about, you know, when we look to the U.S. In many ways as, of course, a pinnacle of higher education. And I'm wondering, from your standpoint, how do you see this graduating class of 24?
Yeah, I think it makes full sense, because it's exactly what I observe when I compare my American students at Franklin and the Swiss students at University of Zurich, where I'm still from time to time. So it's much more an issue, and this, the activism and protesting our American students are much more excited about. And I think it's exactly because they were locked in much more during the pandemics than our Swiss students were here. And here you see far less movement, or at least is less student-based movement. Is basically, we had the same protests over the last 20 years as we have now in Zurich, and it's really a different thing on campuses in the U.S. And maybe one more thing is also the Israel-Palestine conflict was always mapped more on identity politics than other conflicts. And I think it's also very much related to that. And this is why in the U.S. it attracts more attention, because it links quite well to this cultural conflict we have between progressives and conservatives.
From your observation as well, again, you have a great international student body, Marcus, on one side. Of course, you have many domestic students as well. But I'm just wondering whether you'd also see this slight sort of division, as you're saying, you know, American students want to maybe jump on the activist bus versus, yeah, I'm not saying it's a laissez-faire approach, but maybe, again, different set of concerns, the problems of the U.S. And of course, we're talking about Gaza, Israel. This is some would say it's a regional issue. Some would say it's a global issue, but different sets of priorities as well.
Yeah, maybe we should point to another perspective. And I think the business model of an American university is much more driven by finance side and by investors and by all the huge money that comes in from alumni and all that stuff. That changes the discussion tremendously, I think, because then you have got a pressure that comes from the people that are giving the money. On the western, on the eastern side of the United States, they are very liberal on this. To the Ivy League colleges, they want to have a stand in on a certain side. Then you've got the challenge that the politicians all of a sudden can rule into the universities to a certain extent, which gives the whole conflict, I think, a whole different level that we have here in Switzerland. And I need to be honest, we don't have that much American students around. We've got more European ones, we've got more Asian ones. Maybe we are lucky, but the discussions that we are having we're trying to take it very differentiated when it comes up and try to look at it from different perspectives. And so I'm feeling a little bit on the other side of all these demonstrations. But on the other hand, coming from Berlin and thinking back on the times of 68 when I was born, universities were always the place where you need to have those conflicts, where you see the pinnacle of it. So there's a certain continuity in there. And to a certain extent, I think sometimes it's good when they speak up during the student times and they learn how to make themselves heard. If it gets against the law, it's a different thing. But you need to discuss hard and heavy, so to say, which is not Swiss strength, so to say.
Garni, you're nodding vigorously there.
My head is going to sort of fall off my neck. No, I do really agree with this last point about the perils of falling into the trap of presentism and thinking that there is something very unique about student protests at this very point in time, right? Because a lot of these allusions to actually anti-Vietnam protests are coming into forefront as we see these discussions play out. And really, in the context of, you know, policing on campuses, in terms of what the response of the administrators is and so on. So I don't think that this is so much of an anomaly, but just basically something that we are now seeing over a different different issue. And also coming on the heels of what we've seen over the past couple of years, you said the pandemic, but also, for instance, Black Lives Matter protests that very much swept across campuses and so on. We have to understand we are talking about a different political and cultural context. In the United States, I mean, this is now a trope almost to say U.S. is so polarized, right? The hyper-partisanship, the politicization of pretty much everything in the society leads to these sort of things. And I think what has supercharged and sort of turbocharged this particular issue is the fact that, you know, the social media is playing a role in this. The fact that we have seen some of the images of October 7th play out very much so vividly in the eyes of many. And then this follows on the kind of conversations we are having and what we've heard also from your colleague about the domestic politics in Israel itself. And that's why I'm saying we need to be careful here what exactly we are talking about, because there are many layers where we really need to avoid conflating the sort of anti-Israeli government rhetoric, right, versus actually something that is horrible and despicable, right, which is anti-Semitism, which we need to condemn and point out every time. And then maybe one final point, if we take a look at actually where some of these protests are taking place, for instance, I'm very well familiar with Columbia University, its campuses on Morningside Heights, right? It's a very porous campus where actually people can walk in, right, where you can have protesters joining in what could be student sit-ins, right, and make that sort of element maybe more violent, more extreme, and so on. And so, you know, there are a lot of things that we just standing here in Zurich might not be very much sort of first-handedly kind of exposed to, and therefore we need to be careful. So, yeah.
Andrew, I just want to bring you in from a London perspective, because what we're hearing here, you know, we're sitting in the middle of the continent having this conversation, and we always talk about that sense of nuance, and there's certainly the sense that maybe, and of course this is something that we're covering in the magazine all the time, you know, does Europe play a cultural as much as a political role, and in terms of also being sort of a buffer to, you know, all of these things which are exported from the US, which then also get taken on board by corporations, they get taken on by governments, they get taken on by campuses as their own cause and issue because of the power of US media, because of the power of these companies, the power of English language. And I'm wondering, do UK campuses, but also does London, you know, even have an interesting role to play as also almost being this buffer zone? Because of course, you know, we've seen, you know, more identity, you know, flare-ups in Cambridge. You know, you've got some UK universities really standing very hard about freedom of speech in a very different way from the US. And I'm wondering what role the UK might play in all of this.
Well, I think because it's coming from the level of government, you know, and many universities and campuses are dependent on grants and a system of finance which doesn't leave them totally independent. I think many of the people who are the heads of colleges and universities realize that they do have a responsibility here to do their best to maintain a level of free speech. So that's it's crunchy when it impacts other people's individual freedoms and community freedoms. But I think that many of the universities are trying at the top level to keep this notion of debate going. I think campuses have always been, especially here in the UK, kind of, you know, tough debating grounds. You know, I was at university just in the wake of the miners' strike here in the UK, and I remember being at university when the debates were, you know, South Africa, we had a far-right movement here at the time, the National Front. I think nearly every student had a, you know, an anti-NF badge on their lapel. So the debate, and even back then, that, you know, there was, you know, the debate about linguistics, about whether you could have a blackboard or a chalkboard. So even then, you know, what we're determined now as woke was part of the conversation, maybe not at the level we have now. So some of that is just what you need from students. They need to be engaged and angry and looking at the issues of the day, because they will come to change society, hopefully for the better in the future. But I think here in London, I don't know, I empathise with Jewish friends I speak to who say they just would not go into London on a Saturday wearing anything that signified that they were Jewish if they were going to go on the subway, for example. And that can't be a situation that we end up in thinking is tolerable. It should be that both sides can get on the subway and have a conversation, but not feel that they are intimidated so much that they can't be present in the centre of the city. So it's difficult. No one's going to win at this game. But that's the nature of wars. No one wins in the end, do they?
Gorna, just we were touching on France a little bit earlier. Obviously, Monsieur Macron, Prime Minister Attal, as well, wanting to push back. They're focusing on this mini protest, I guess, going on at Sciences Po in Paris. But if we go to another campus at the Sorbonne earlier in the week, we had quite an extraordinary, very impassioned speech by President Macron, who was really, it was a rallying cry for Europe. We've seen in Le Figaro this morning, almost off the back of that, the sort of almost ratcheting up in terms of his narrative now, saying we have to have an honest discussion about, broader nuclear armament for all of Europe as well. Maybe distill what he was saying. Is this really, was it a kick in the ass for Europe? Is it a rallying cry? Is this also something else entirely different in a way in the run-up, of course, to the European parliamentary elections?
Sure.
Distill that in 30 seconds, Gorana.
Yes, a little bit of column A, column B, and column C that you just mentioned. I would say we have to look at this speech also in the context of this being the second Sorbonne speech. So he gave one in 2017. And I think that this was probably the moment where he comes and says, I told you so, right? Because when in 2017 he said, Europe needs to be, more sovereign, more autonomous in all of these different ways, everyone was just dismissing him as this sort of very precocious, ambitious, political whiz kid who has just come into power and wants to build what he said a Jupiterian presidency, right? That he's going to be one of these kind of Napoleonic almost figures, right, in the context of broader European history. This time around, I think he comes with a speech saying, if that wasn't a wake-up call, now we see what happens, right? We see what happened during the pandemic in the wake of Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine, the ensuing war, and so on. And basically what we are seeing as the world becomes even more competitive, right, as we see basically Europe being caught, as he sees, in this great power competition between the United States and China. And his main point, if you want, at least for someone who studies security and international relations, is that Europe needs to basically carve out a third way, right? That's his main pitch. Not to be what he said, a vassal of the United States, right? But to basically have a sort of strategy of its own, whether it comes to defense or trade, right? He basically says for far too long we have depended on Russia for energy, on the United States for protection, on for China for trade. We need to be more strategically autonomous, whether it comes to security or economy.
Oliver.
Thanks. So it's great to have Gorana here because she has the international relations perspective while I have very much the domestic politics perspective. And I mean, Macron is also the master of cheap talk, right? And he's absolutely desperate about the polling numbers for his movement in France. There are European elections soon. I think this was very also domestic politics. In the polls, it could even be that the socialists go above them in the European elections. And there can only be like one large force against the Front. It's not the Front National anymore, right? It's the Rassemblement National. So I see it very much from a domestic politics perspective. Lots of cheap talk, because if you look at, for example, support for Ukraine, is not so impressive what France is doing. So I think the discrepancy, and this is often the case with Macron, between what he's claiming to do and what he's asking the other to do and what France is actually doing in international relations is very distinct.
Gorana, just quickly before we go back to Andrew in London with his lighter, perkier story for the end of this half hour. What's your take on that in terms of course, playing to the electorate on one side, but also there's something else going on here as well, which, of course, you can focus on everything which is happening, you know, on the borders beyond. But you can also talk about a security issue, which is happening within France's own borders as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would completely agree with this point that there is the domestic level that certainly is an interesting aspect to it, especially given that he can't be reelected, right, as well. And his ratings are abysmal. So the sort of utility of some of these sort of grandstanding exercises can be questioned as well. But on in terms of security overall, I think the kind of I will put it more broadly in the context of European integration. What we are seeing these days is that even people who came to politics as arguably centrist, right, have adopted this language these days that basically is reducing European Union now to something that's going to be very much more akin to a fortress Europe, both in terms of security of borders, of, you know, even the language of the present commission with protecting something called the European way of life, which if it is the Negroni that you mentioned or Apero and so on, then great. But if it is something that's more pernicious, then we have to be careful, at least in my point of view. And then something that is going to be an entity that is going to be both, you know, again, economically protected, right? The kind of return of protectionism that we see all across the board, right? European Union is just responding to what we are seeing across the Atlantic, what we are seeing in China and so on, but very much a turn away from what we've seen over the past, you know, 20, 30 years of this kind of hyper-integration, trade liberalization, right? The sort of era of the so-called Washington Consensus that was adapted to the European Union model. So in that sense, it is very much a sort of telltale of how even those who were centrist, and these days even the more kind of center-left, are adopting this language that is looking way more inward rather than being more open to the world.
Andrew, how is that for a Sunday morning primer for you?
Well, around Europe and some wise words and good. And a debate, as always, that's held at Monocle that seems to be common sense.
Andrew Kay, what's the light story you've got from us from the UK?
Well, it's quite a reasonable sized story in the Daily Telegraph today, and it's about whether naked people devalue the price of property. So, in Portsmouth, and they've whipped this story up as out of nothing, I have to admit, because it's all ifs, buts, maybes. But anyway, in Portsmouth, they're going to develop a piece of old MOD land into apartments.
That's just for our listeners, Ministry of Defence, just so
Ministry of Defence. Apologies, yeah. Yes, Ministry of Defence. So it's an old site that's going to be turned into luxury apartments. Unfortunately, there's a piece of beach in front of it where for 70 years naturists have been sunbathing, and they're claiming the locals that they won't be able to get £1 million unless they manage to clear off the wrinkly old nakeds, because they found another place up in Fife in Scotland, and I can't believe up in Fife in Scotland anyone would dare take their clothes off other than 1 or 2 days a year. But anyway, up on a beach in Fife in Scotland where house prices are apparently 36% lower because of the appearance of naked people on the beach in front of those properties. So anyway, they've counted lots of people about what their feeling is, and they've got some very good quotes. Anyway, this one is: moreover, the nudists don't contribute to anything locally in the economy. So if they're really desperate to sunbathe naked, they can go to Hailing Island on the ferry. You see, they don't buy any clothes, you see, Tyler, when they're there.
That's the problem. I was going to say, there's no beach wrap-ups. There's certainly no swimwear sales. I can agree. I mean, maybe there's obviously there's probably some sunscreen sales, but, you know, there's not probably a huge margin on Nivea or whatever else it would be. But then, Andrew, I think it is, of course, the question, well, is like, what bodies, right? And, you know, if you said you had, like, the hottest bodies outside of your window, it doesn't matter what age you are, maybe, of course, then you'd see a 30% rise, not just in property.
Well, yes. And you were talking about a perky story, Tyler.
Indeed.
So, yes, but anyway, we'll see how it debates. And it also turns out that the poor nudists have already been shoved to an end of the beach, which has a sewage issue as well. So I don't think that's the main concern for people looking out of their £1 million apartment windows.
Andrew, thanks very much for that. I think hopefully Emma Nelson is standing by with our news headlines. Emma.
I Thank you very much indeed, Tyler. An internal memo written by senior US officials has suggested Israel may be violating international law in Gaza. The officials advised Secretary of State Antony Blinken that they do not find credible or reliable Israel's assurance that it is using US-supplied weapons in accordance with humanitarian law. Meanwhile, Hamas has published a video appearing to show two hostages being held in Gaza. The men say they want a deal that will secure their release. Israel has described the video as propaganda. Thousands of supporters of Spain's Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez have attended a rally in Madrid imploring him not to step down. Mr. Sanchez said he was withdrawing from public duties after a court opened an inquiry into corruption allegations against his wife. And the British retailer John Lewis says job applicants will now be allowed to see interview questions beforehand in to try to make the process fairer. The department and supermarket chain has published questions for all job levels. The firm's head of talent said interviews would be no less rigorous, but that nerves can affect performance. And those are the headlines. Back to you, Tyler, in Zurich.
Oh, my goodness. you set me up for that one.
Yes, I did. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I mean, what happened to the world of merit and resilience and also being put on the spot? Because you can imagine, right, that you show up in the electronics department of John Lewis and you want to know where maybe the swimwear is or where I'm going to find sunscreen because I'm heading down to a nudist beach on the South Coast. You know, don't you think that, you know, when you're in sort of the realm of a department store, that maybe someone should be able to answer those questions?
You're quite right. It's the fact that it is a department store which absolutely inherently deals with people is one of the things that absolutely baffles me. I mean, if you're going to go and live in cyberspace and you're going to hold yourself up in your bedroom and do coding forever, then one could understand that your interpersonal skills might not be absolutely necessary. But there's also that thing that actually nerves are quite good because it means that you care and you can really, you know, you can focus and you can practice. I was interested to know what you think, Marcus, about when you deal with your students and whether you would, when you're interviewing or when you're practicing things, whether you would actually let them see the questions beforehand.
Well, on the one hand, I think when it's about the questions, I don't think you're right, from my point of view, down to the point, because I believe that a lot of stuff that is happening in hospitality or service orientation is more of a capability and mentality thing that you can't really get out to interviews. When you look at top hotels, they do short interviews, but the rest is really, are they able of doing service? Do they want to do the service? And I think this is sort of a behavioral component that is much, much more developed with people in their character than just they can claim it on an interview. So from my point of view, if you go down to a retail store and nobody knows where the aisle is, where you're looking for something, then you're right in the middle of the hurricane. People will not come back. So the basic idea should be that they learn from the first day onwards. It's about hospitality. It's about being friendly and helping people. And these people are hard to find, but I don't know if you really find them over the interviews.
No, and Emma, I think you raise a point as well, which I thought was maybe where you were going with the question with Marcus, which is also, you know, this sort of onward push towards, you know, digital as well. Because I can imagine also someone at John Lewis might say, well, oh, we have it on the app when you go into the store, so you should actually be able to go and find the sun cream and the swimwear. Just go and look at the app. But it's like, well, that still takes me time. Maybe I don't have the app, actually. Maybe I don't even have a smartphone, potentially. And if I think about, you know, the struggle that John Lewis has trying desperately to bring in a younger audience in the UK and actually then ignoring their core right now as well, which is, yeah, probably north of 45.
And don't get me started on trying to use apps inside a shop.
There's another question as well, right? I mean, when you're sort of buffeted by, you know, just aisles and aisles of clothing and you're, you know, whatever, 300 metres away from a signal at that point, good luck.
Yes, and you have the additional issue that actually when you get an angry customer, then you move into crisis management, and that's when you need communications better than anybody, because if you start to have a row with your customer because you're not trained in how to be nice to people or how to cope with angry people, then, as Marcus said, people are going to leave.
Yeah, you know, and on the other hand, I think it's really important that we understand that this whole retail experience, it's... Okay, just one figure to put it into perspective. In Germany, 60,000 jobs are open in sales. So you're so hardly looking for people that are still motivated of doing that job on the floor, that when I was just in Singapore, one of the major issues, and Emma, don't kill me for that, what really makes life easy for customers is that everywhere there's a QR code where you can drop down to the app because nobody's in the store, and then they can help you. And if you've got somebody in the store who's not motivated and looking at all the luxury brands where they're hanging on their smartphone because they're just looking for the different sizes they have to present, I don't know if those jobs are really attractive right now. And that's, from my point of view, the real big issue. How does retail bring up experiences that are related to the human factor? And on the other hand, how you bring experiences to life that make people stay within the store, maybe without somebody standing there? There is no option to this. It's like in restaurants. You don't find the people that want to be a waiter. So we are running into a problem. And the robots in the restaurants, they're horrible, of course. But the idea behind it is really you need to find the truffle in the mud. And that's really hard to find.
Yeah.
It's more than just an interview checklist or something like that. It's a real problem for a whole industry, I think.
Emma, it sounds like Marcus is setting up. This is a whole new degree that could be done and delivered, or it's a series of documentaries to unravel the service problem, which is a huge issue.
It is an enormous issue, and it goes back to millennia, the way that we interact with each other. Apparently, it takes your brain 4 seconds to make a decision about the person that you meet, and after that, it's really hard for your brain to change its mind. It's kind of set itself in stone. So when you have someone who's walked in and has their interview prepped, that they've got off, dare I say, ChatGPT, or their friends have drilled it into them, or they've just got a piece of paper that they're going to read out of. It makes you think, do I actually want to work with this person? Or are they just going to sort of go on their phones the whole time and stare at their toes?
Exactly. Maybe on that note, we should bring in our correspondent in Istanbul. Hannah Lucinda Smith is standing by. And I want to start off, though, of course, there is this global, service problem. And sometimes I wonder, is it a global problem as well? Because I think some nations are actually set up in a better way. Just coming from Spain, you realize that actually there is the Spanish diaspora that they can rely on, that they were able to, of course, have people from Ecuador, people coming from Venezuela, all over the Spanish-speaking world. If you've got some almost remote sliver of a link back to Europe, come on in, because there are tables to be served, there are beds to be made. I'm wondering, in a Turkish context, is this a conversation, especially as we move into, of course, one of the most important periods for Turkish tourism? And good morning, by the way.
Good morning. Hi. It's really striking. Whenever I come back to Britain, I'm always really struck by the level of automation in, particularly in supermarkets. I mean, you just don't see sort of self-service booths here in Turkey. It's pretty much the other way in restaurants. They tend to be sort of overstaffed. They do have obviously a large immigrant population coming in and moving through. A lot of young people looking for work. So I think there's different dynamics at play. Tourism is a huge part of the industry, of course, and every summer you see a huge movement, an internal movement of migrant labour, particularly people of Kurdish origin coming from the east to the resorts in the western coast, places like Antalya and Fethiye and places like that, to work in the hotels, work in the restaurants, work in the bars. So, yeah, different dynamics, I think. But, I find it very, very odd coming back to Britain these days.
Maybe should we stay on a tourism note? You teased us with a couple of stories at the start, but maybe one is, of course, this reopening of a 16th century hammam in Istanbul.
Yeah, so this is the Zeyrek Çinili Hammam. It's one of the Ottoman Empire's most famous architects, probably the most famous architect. Mimar Sinan designed the Blue Mosque in Sultanahmet and other famous mosques. But this was one of his early projects. It was a hammam in the Zeyrek district, which isn't too far from the Hagia Sophia and the Blue Mosque. Originally, it was fully tiled with these hand-painted tiles. And it's been in constant use since it opened in the 1540s, but gradually sort of falling into more and more disrepair in recent years. It was bought by a Turkish family company just over a decade ago. They've spent a really long time and a lot of effort restoring it, not only restoring it, but really uncovering its layers, really finding out about the sort of fragments they found. They found cisterns when they were doing the renovations, basilica cisterns, and it's just a fantastic place. It's opening this week. It's opening on Friday. And I had a bit of a look round in December, just before the heating system was turned back on. It's really something quite special and kind of haunting to be in a hammam when it's clear of steam.
I bet. Now, listen, if we head south from Istanbul, something quite interesting, again, obviously on a tourism note as well. And it's quite interesting that we're now seeing that there's going to be obviously visa on arrival for, of course, Turkish visitors going on to the Greek islands. And I'm wondering sort of how widespread that is, or if this is just contained, or if it's for all Turks coming into Greece at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually a little bit more complex than it was sort of originally touted. It was back in December that Turkish press first started reporting that Turks were going to be able to get this 7-day visa on arrival for 10 of the islands, the Greek islands that are closest to Turkey. So that's places like Samos, Lesbos, Chios. They're really, really close. I mean, the closest Samos is less than a kilometre away at the closest point. But up until the beginning of this month, Turks had to get a Schengen visa. They had to go through the full process of getting a Schengen visa if they wanted to go to those islands. And in recent years, that's not been easy. So obviously, you know, this is really, really good for Turks. You know, they're somewhere, you know, on their doorstep that they rarely get to travel to. Actually, what they still have to do is provide a certain amount of documentation a few days before, and then their name is basically checked prior to arrival. But it does make it a lot easier, and tens of thousands of Turks went to those islands in the Bayram holiday earlier this month. So I think, you know, over the summer, those islands, they're already providing menus in Turkish, you know, providing services for the Turkish tourists. So I think it's really going to be a boom year for those islands.
And who's the core target? Because, of course, you know, we just see, if we look at, yeah, just the sheer number of openings at that end of the Mediterranean, when you look at properties, new villas, etc., you know, it's exploding in Greece at the moment as well. Of course, you look at what's happening in Bodrum, Şeşme, etc. So I'm wondering, is this sort of going top end of the market, or where is the focus?
No, I think it's very much the kind of middle class. I mean, what I've noticed, particularly over the past 5 years, is that the kind of class of Turks, maybe small business owners, maybe teachers, people like that, who, you know, 10 years ago would have enough disposable income to go on holiday in Turkey a few times a year and go to Europe once a year. Getting a visa was a lot easier. There was a lot more equity between the euro and the lira at that point. Their kind of ability to do that has really been hit. And, you know, this is a good opening for them. The other thing is that, you know, the inflation in Turkey has actually made holidaying in Turkey unaffordable for those people. It's actually cheaper now for a lot of things in Greece, which, you know, wasn't the case 10 years ago. So I think it's very much, yeah, those people who for the past few years have been sort of cut off from taking a foreign holiday.
Just finally, before we go, this was a story which I think made headlines certainly all over Europe, and not least in the German press. German President Frank-Walter Steinmeier, he had his visit to Turkey this week, and of course, yeah, there really a story erupted around the symbolism of this 60-kilogram doner kebab that was brought, almost unveiled by him. How did it play out, if I would have been reading the pages of Hurriyet, or did Hurriyet even care?
Well, I mean, the visit was actually very well received in Turkey, and I was just doing a quick scan of the Turkish press reporting about this visit just before I came on air. And one thing that really amused me is one Turkish paper called The Kebab Maker, who came with President Steinmeister, a grilled meat artisan. So, yeah, in Turkey, it was very well received. But there were German Turks back in Germany who were quite put out. They said, listen, you know, German Turks are, you know, the scientists at Pfizer who came up with the COVID vaccine. There are so many illustrious German Turks, and to reduce us to this sort of common stereotype. You know, on the other hand, Arif Kelesh, who is the kebab maker who came from Berlin with President Steinmeister, he's, you know, really part of a kind of kebab dynasty success story. He's the third generation. In his family, his grandfather came over as one of the Gastarbeiter, established his kebab restaurant, and has been very, very successful from it. So, you know, I think there are always two ways to look at this. But in Turkey, certainly, you know, it was seen as a very big success.
I have to bring in Marcus because we have a Berliner around the table. So viewing Steinmeier's visit and the way this exploded. This certainly dominated the wires and the front pages for 36 hours, Marcus. Your speak as a Berliner from neutral Switzerland.
I was proud because, to be honest, when street food comes to a Berliner, there's either currywurst or döner kebab. And I would say, and this is now Berlin speak, we invented it sort of in Berlin, the way that we eat it out of the bread and all that stuff. So that's the positive side. And of course, the lines between Turkish people and German people, for me, it's blurred. And it's not the line that you say you were the son of a Gastarbeiter and so on. And I think that's the most important thing to say. It's part of our European German culture and especially Berlin culture to have a kebab as well as having very smart people around doing great business in Germany, having fantastic engineers on that side. On the other hand, how do you make it pronounced to show how important culture is when it's not about food?
Exactly. Hannah, just before we go, so not just maybe from the symbolism of grilled meat artisans, but politically also, any big announcements that came out of it that was important in terms of bilateral relations between Germany and Turkey?
Yeah, of course. Well, those relations have been fraught, to say the least, over the past few years, but really, it seemed like both Steinmeier and Erdogan were keen to present it as a kind of new beginning. Interestingly, Steinmeier also visited Ekrem İmamoğlu, who is the recently re-elected opposition mayor of Istanbul. That was taken as a bit of a sign that, he also came to build links with what he thinks might be the next government here in Turkey.
Very good. Hannah Lucinda Smith, our correspondent for us in Istanbul. Thanks very much. We're going away for a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking about the merits of small nations.
Do you want the tactility of print and the speed of digital? Well, sign up for a Monocle subscription today and enjoy 10 issues plus 4 annual specials, as well as access to the Monocle Digital Editions. The Monocle Digital Editions offers improved access to the magazine on the go and at the touch of a button. It also includes our extensive archive of global reporting and a growing roster of travel guides and tips too. Head to monocle.com/subscribe to sign up now.
And you're back with Monocle on Sunday with me, Tyler Berlay. Just coming up to 10:50 and 30 seconds here in Zurich. I'm very happy to say that the author R. James Brading is here. He's a founder of the nonprofit SA Nations. He has a new book out, What Goliath Can Learn from David, Big Lessons from Small Nations. Each chapter details how 11 small nations dealt with a critical public policy challenge and how we can learn from their success. James, good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Maybe just set up what the nonprofit does as well. I think your name will be familiar, I think, to many listeners, but just maybe set out your stall for us first.
Well, I, in the course of doing the research of my last book about small successful countries, actually in the middle of sort of field research in Denmark at Novo Nordisk, the idea came up to maybe do some sort of an organization, a bit sort of pendant to the G7, where the criteria of admission is excellence and not size. So that was basically the genesis of the whole thing.
And then, of course, we're sitting here in Switzerland, a country also with a flag with a red background and a white cross on it as well. I'm already sort of like now going through all these small nations as well, thinking, is there a commonality between red and white? I'm jumping to Singapore quickly. No cross on that flag, of course, but some other symbolism. But maybe just tell us about the book. And of course, people are going to wonder where they can get the book in a moment. We'll come back to that. But when we go through these 11 nations, and if you can sort of rhyme them off and the commonality, and of course, I think many of us around the table and further know, of course, the luxury that small countries have in terms of being able to affect policy in short order to galvanize, of course, communities, etc. But just tell us where it takes us.
So I originally just looked, there's 204 countries in the world. I just looked at all types of metrics. So if you're a doctor sort of examining a patient, you'd do blood tests and EKGs, et cetera, and you look at things like GDP per capita or PISA scores or happiness indices, et cetera. So we looked at across all these metrics. And, you know, you would expect maybe some economies of scale, like you would see in everything else, that the bigger the country, the better the country. And it's actually not the case at all. If you look at the correlation, it's more or less, you know, zero in terms of regression coefficient. So there is no correlation. They're effectively random. But then I also noticed in doing that work that there were some outliers. There were sort of these 10-ish type countries that continue to appear, you know, whatever metric you choose, and social cohesion or, you know, confidence in government, whatever it might be. And these were countries like Denmark, Singapore, Switzerland, Netherlands, Finland, et cetera, the countries that I know you're a big fan of. And we come at this whole thing very independently. And I do think sort of, for example, design is one way of looking at that type of thing. So, yeah, that's how it sort of originated. And then they're actually very different countries, different in terms of, you know, you have a Confucian country in Singapore, you have a Catholic country in Ireland, you have a Lutheran country in Denmark and Switzerland, Calvinism, etc. So, and they all historically are very different. Some of them are very new countries like Singapore. Some of them are very old countries like Denmark, Switzerland. Some of them are turnaround situations like Ireland. So, it's, you know, it's actually quite encouraging to see that the starting point was very different. So that, I think that gives hope to sort of other countries. But we could talk about some of the common elements if you want.
Indeed. Well, actually, the good thing is we've got maybe two people around the table to also maybe do not a live review of the book, but I think challenging or certainly maybe agreeing with you. But you know, Oliver, I mean, you've been in this country for a while, and I think when we look at this, I mean, what's your take?
I just have a question for you, which is what is the role of small countries need to be more open, because they cannot depend fully on their own economy, let's say, like economic stimulus cannot come just only from inside. So they tend to need to be more open in terms, at least, of economic relations. Is this an important reason?
It's a critical criteria. It's openness, connectivity. So if you look at these countries, they have a much higher degree of exports as a percentage of their economy. The people that actually live outside of the country, I mean, you mentioned diaspora before, the foreigners that live in the country, the percentage of foreigners. I mean, here in this country, you probably have, you know, close to 35% if you include these so-called secundas.
And then
Singapore has 50%. So, you know, and if you look at innovation, it's really mostly about what they call adjacency. You know, the idea that you have to be sort of close to things and sort of rub off on something. I mean, your idea about the kebab was probably some sort of a fusion at some point.
I'm also just wondering, though, as well, we talk about innovation, but I'm also wondering, and Grant, I'm looking at you from a, I guess, you know, again, we were just touching on domestic security policy as well. How important is also integration when you're a small country? Because also things can also destabilize very quickly, or things can tip in a very, you know, speedy direction if you have, of course, a populace who is not on page, who is not following the vision. And so it's, you know, in one way we look at it, sort of the luxury of these countries, but it's also a tricky balance, especially at a time of migration where we have to, of course, be looking at labor. But it's a question of who comes in and how do they also behave within your very small living room?
No, those are great questions. And I think maybe from the kind of classical political science perspective, the kind of social contract and the kind of cohesion of the society, the kind of buy-in into this project of kind of the national project is so important. And it reminds me of way back when I used to teach a class on divided societies. There's this great article from ages ago on comparison between Costa Rica and Nicaragua and why Costa Rica went the other way, why it was more prosperous than Nicaragua when all things kind of held equal. They're very similar, and it's basically about the buying of the story on part of the population to actually believe in something that's greater than them, the kind of constructivist idea of a state. But to me, what's really interesting with this idea of what the small countries can teach the big ones, I think in the era of great power competition, really, you are touching on countries that are in sort of interesting positions geographically as well, to be able to actually choose their path sometimes, or because of some path dependence historically, not to be pulled necessarily, or to still maintain, even if they're allied, right, to maintain a degree of autonomy, right? And to me, very interesting, the countries that you mention in Europe are either former empires or traditionally neutral, right? And so those sort of questions are really interesting in the context of how not to get wrapped up really in what we were talking about, you know, the sort of great power competition. I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
It's an interesting sort of gauntlet she's thrown in front of you.
Yeah, so all these countries have unique path dependencies, if you like. So, and I think that makes them worthwhile in studying. I think they're increasingly sort of laboratories of the world as well, because they're also better able to, well, for two factors. One, to his point, they're subject to external forces, and therefore they have to adapt. They have to be nimble. They have to react. So, I mean, what Ty, you were saying, for example, the reaction to, you know, sort of populist-type readers, we are more likely to see that in a place like, say, Sweden more quickly than we would, say, in other places. And therefore, they're sort of laboratories. And then the more important thing is that not only will they see these changes, but they're better able to intermediate a social political consensus and get something done. Because you have the situation, for example, in the U.S. with gridlock, or in the case of the UK with Brexit, Germany's becoming increasingly sclerotic, etc. So we see these countries more as showcases of where you actually can get something done.
Oliver, when you hear this as well, and it's interesting how you bring up Sweden as well, because Sweden's a good example of what we're talking about, of course, that here you've had, you know, mass migration and a very changed nation as well. You know, you look back to Sweden a decade ago, did not have the internal security issues, did not have the crime issues that it had. And is this does this also become a cautionary tale as well? When you're a small country, that maybe you need to sort of get on top of things. If you're a Canada, well, it's a little bit more diffuse. You're 30 million plus people. It's a different story.
Yeah, I think it's important maybe also now in the context of Switzerland and the Russian invasion. Oh, you see also that small countries must also then adapt. No, they must not become too proud of their successful histories and remain maybe modest and aware that they're lucky.
Are you saying in code, or not quite, that small countries can be smug?
Kind of, yes. I leave it to Gorana.
Yeah. Keep me out of it. No, but it's true, though. I was thinking about, you know, there is a certain sense of smugness in Switzerland. Let's face it, there's a certain sense. There's definitely a sense of smugness. Marcus, you just came from Singapore as well. And of course, you know, it's almost ingrained in the Singaporeans that, you know, they have, of course, their national think, you could say, and they are supreme.
I mean, when you come to Singapore, and this is just one case, I think, I'm talking to my students and I'm saying, give them the time to be proud. They came from third country to first, whoever did this, and in large part was done by the population. And I think it's worthwhile looking at it and understanding that this pride, from my point of view, is something that builds the identity. And to be honest, me as a German coming to Switzerland, Switzerland is proud as well. So this pride, I think, is much, much more important. And it builds and it gives you the backbone for moving forward. And it's a motivational thing to a certain extent. I agree. There are negative sides to this as well, because you get lazy, you get too much slack. But on the other hand, when I go to Singapore and see my students there, they say, wow, you know. And that's what they should learn, that other countries are doing well, as better than them.
So I agree with both of you that the national think, as you say, is really an important factor. Yeah. I mean, people have sort of lost faith in nationalism as a sort of national pride, etc., and people are groping with that issue. And I do think in these smaller countries, they, in part because they have a better trade-off between the community and the individual.
Right.
I mean, if you look at places like the U.S., I mean, there's absolute, you know, non plus ultra in terms of, you know, the number of Nobel Prize winners, the number of unicorns, the number of billionaires, the Mayo Clinic, the Ivy League schools, etc. But at the communal level, across the whole spectrum of government, you know, starting from police forces to posts to, you know, pension funds to you know, airports, whatever you want to call it, I mean, it's a disaster. I mean, for the wealthiest country in the world, it ranges from mediocre to really awful.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, childcare, for example, for a woman. You know, of 44 countries in the world, they're ranked last.
Yeah. And that reminds me of, I mean, this is a kind of well-studied phenomenon of social capital in a country, right? The whole Robert Putnam argument of bowling alone, that in the United States we have seen basically the decrease in membership of all sorts of these communal kind of organizations. Of course, there are different perspectives, but there is a thing that maybe on this communal aspect, as you say, that there is something that is at the micro level, right? If we kind of study levels of governance, that really, if you want to create a successful national project, you actually need to build communities. You need to start from very small to actually build it up on top. And maybe that's where smaller countries have an easier time doing that than maybe those that are bigger, that are maybe harder to manage. But even then, right, we see that historically it was sometimes easier, right? And what is it that takes a country actually to build around that, right? Do we need a war? Do we need some sort of external threat to come together? That's kind of not
the
story.
This is a big topic, Goran. We're going to have to come back to this one, which is, you know, do we need a war?
We don't.
We don't. But this is a theme that actually does keep coming back, saying that, you know, how are we going to sort of, you know,
mobilize
people, get everyone on the same page, get everyone out of their comfy trousers, have a sense of identity, but we can talk about that in another program. James, just quickly though, before we go, tell us, book is out when? Where do people find it? There's listeners in New Zealand, spanning all the way to the U.S. West Coast. Where are we going to find it?
Amazon or your local bookstore. It just came out last week, a few days ago. In fact, I'm still waiting for the books.
I was going to say this is. There's no signing around the table here morning, right? Exactly.
I got this phone call. 36 hours ago.
Yeah, well, that's what happens when you email me, James. So, and just tell me very quickly before we wrap here, how does this also, I guess, develop and extend itself? Does it become a conference? Is there a series about all 11 nations? What do you want to do with this?
So I think, I mean, just coming back to your point, I think what begs explanation is success, not failure. I mean, take for example your point about immigration, which is quite an experiment. I mean, if you compare to immigration 20 years ago, we're having lots of problems. We have, you know, lower reproduction rates. We have this issue about if you want to continue to grow, you have to replace people through immigration. And if you have a case of Singapore, which has done an absolutely brilliant job acclimating Malays, you know, Chinese, Indians. If you go to a taxi in Singapore, they say, "I am Singaporean. I'm not, you know, from, you know, Punjab or something." So it's you know, I think they've done some remarkable. There's a lot of success stories, and that's probably the, if you like, the raison d'être of this whole movement that we have with S8 is one of the key mantras is to find the success and to celebrate the success, because, you know, learning and progressing is finding something that works and then reversing and engineering, whether it's an iPhone or whether it's a wheel. And this is what we want to do. And the information corridors are Los Angeles, Chicago, New York, Berlin, Shanghai. So you don't hear about these stories from Finland or, you know, Estonia, etc. So I thank you very much in that respect for, you know, encouraging that.
Well, yeah, we try our best at Monocle. I mean, to give these nations and otherwise, a little bit of a bigger stage. Great, Goran, really fantastic having you on the show, and we look forward to coming back. And maybe we're going to sort of hold you to the point about do we need a war or not? We know we don't, but Oliver Stravis as well, Marcus Schugel, of course, Emma Nelson back in London, and thanks, James, to you, Hannah Lucinda Smith in Istanbul, Andrew Tucker, editor in chief in London, plus Mariella Bevan and Emma Nelson, of course, overseeing all of this from London. Linus Vivian here looking after all of the audio. I'm Tyler Berlay. Monocle on Sunday is back next week, and we're on a bit of a 3-week run here in Zurich. So come by on a Sunday morning to see us. Have a good day. Bye-bye.